woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
Oh, it's, it's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Well, I'm going to face Action Jackson. I'm telling you, just about where we're on the board. SP Futures up 7, NASDAQ Futures up 73, Dow Futures down 3. Lou, how are you?
I'm very good. I just want to note as an initial matter that I did not watch The Big Lebowski. I had not seen The Big Lebowski until about 3 months ago. And... How did Jeff Bridges not get an Oscar for that movie?
I'm jealous of you that you just got to see that movie for the first time, because it's probably my favorite movie of all time, and I've seen it like 400 times.
It is a masterpiece. How did he not get an Oscar?
Well, Chief, I'm sure you haven't seen it, but it came out in probably 1998, if that sounds right, something like that. And
I thought it was a little lower, a little earlier than that, but it was, you know, it was one of the Coen brothers' first movies, I think, right?
It was, yeah, it was like their third or fourth movie.
Their first one was a,
yeah, it was 98. It was 98.
98, okay.
Yeah, cause I remember distinctly when it came out, cause I was, a freshman in high school. And, anyway, yeah.
Jesus, don't say things like that. That's just depressing.
Yeah, but he's getting older right in front of our eyes.
Yes, I am.
It doesn't matter. So am I. Yeah. So are you.
You have to remember that 1998 sounds recent, but it was 23 years ago. But anyway, yeah, that movie, Jeff Bridges is spectacular. John Goodman is spectacular. Even, you know, like the small roles, like John Turturro as Jesus, the creepy bowling guy. I mean, he's just awesome. I mean, the movie is just so good.
It is a fantastic character study. But Bridges carries it, and he carries it beautifully. And I remember seeing it. My wife and I watched it. She had not seen it either. And my sister had been recommending it for years. She said it's like one of her all time favorite films. And I watched it, and I was just really stunned about halfway through. I thought, I can't believe how good Bridges is here, and how well he's carrying everything. Anyway, just an aside. I don't understand how that. Well, I mean, I know, because the movie was quirky and, you know, didn't have any gravitas and all that other stuff.
Who else was that year? They lose
entertaining
to?
Performances. You can't beat Bridges in that role.
But who did he? I mean, who did he lose to? Who were the other people that year? But all kinds of good people.
Well, I'm sure there were. I don't even know. I'm sure there were some serious films out there. But I'm sorry, in terms of just straight up acting performances, it's like. It's like My Cousin Vinny of, what's her face, the
Melissa,
female lead.
Marissa Tomei.
Yes, that got the Oscar. I mean, it was such a fantastic performance, but in a not particularly important movie. But again, just a tremendous role. So anyway, I just thought I'd start off with that. I've been meaning to mention that since we use so much of that dialogue in the in some of our openings. That's just a fantastic performance by Bridges.
Well, I'm glad you've seen it, and it appears that Good Will Hunting kicked everyone's ass in 1998.
Yeah,
which was also a great movie.
It is. But the performances there are not Well, there's not an outstanding performance in that movie like there is in Lebowski, at least in my opinion. So that's what makes Horse Races, but that's a role that ought to get more acknowledgement, rather than sort of being a kind of a, you know, a cultish, has a little bit of a cultish feel to it now.
Yeah, it does. And it looks like Good Will Hunting won a lot of awards. Titanic was actually the winner of the Best Picture in 1998.
Titanic won like 12 awards.
Yeah, and that movie sucked. So
I hated that film.
Terrible movie.
I could hardly wait for that boat to sink. I just, you know, go hit the iceberg, for God's sake, please.
Yeah, that movie, they won so many awards just because it was such a kind of a marvel as far as the graphics of the time, I think. That movie sucked. Like, I don't get why people liked it. But Good Will Hunting, I love. That was a great movie. But Big Lebowski, yeah, it flew under the radar and really didn't get popular until probably 5 or 10 years after it was released.
Well, those guys, they're buddies of Dr. J. They went to high school with him or something.
The Coen brothers, yeah. That's, I remember him saying that.
Yeah. Well, and if you look, I mean, if you look at some of their movies, for example, A Serious Man is made in the neighborhood where I grew up in Bloomington, Minnesota.
Love that movie too.
They hit that late 1960s vibe with that film. And that is a fantastic movie, although it's a completely different kind of film than the Big Lebowski. But it's a very intelligent, thoughtful film, again, filled with a tremendous number of character studies that really stay with you. You know, in Fargo and, yeah, pretty much all of their stuff hits those kind of notes. But Lebowski, just, I was not aware of Bridges' performance and how he took, you know, basically not a superb screenplay, but an intelligent one, but not a superb one, but how he took it and just ran with it in terms of the persona that he created on screen.
First movie I saw him in was Last Picture Show. It was quite a movie.
That's right.
Yeah, he was in that. Timothy Bottoms and Ben Johnson.
Yeah.
And, that talk about a dark movie.
Now there was a movie that almost was like a book.
Oh, dark
in terms of
dark,
character development and style and everything else. Was that Bogdanovich?
I'm not sure, but you know. These guys, the Coen brothers, when Dr. J and I were living on the South Side together, we first started trading. I think one of those guys might have stayed at our place one night. But they had this. The first one that they did was this one called Blood Simple, and the idea was it was if you went into the I won't say the monster genre, but the horror genre, you actually could do those. That's where the films that were costing, you know, I'll pick a number, $500,000 to make or $200,000 to make, all of a sudden became big splashes, and he did real well with those things. So they did that, and then they did another movie. I think it might have been Raising Arizona, or was one before that. I'm not sure. Well, Dr. J's dad was one of the investors. So they put the movie together, they finished the movie, and they tried to sell it. Because an independent group, I mean, this is a long time ago, but if you put a movie together as an independent group, you got to sell it to one of these people, right? Because they've got the distribution. And of course, they're the biggest bleeps on earth, like any other business. And, so they wanted no part of it. Oh, no, it sucks. It's this and that. They didn't anything. So they ended up selling the rights to it in Europe first just to make sure they got all their money back. And then it ended up being a hit here, but I think they ended up having to already sold it to somebody else, a big chunk of it, because they basically believed that it was lousy when it wasn't. And they got kicked around by the people in the know and in the go for a long time, and it was still Paramount and all those guys, and you know, it gave me a very, very dim view of that industry, at least in that era.
If you want to watch some really entertaining television, I mean, and it's entertaining because there's a certain element of nostalgia in it. Netflix has a series called The Films That Made Us, or something like this, that does a really good job of inside. Assessments and the inside story of making a bunch of sort of iconic films. And your comment about the low budget just triggered one, because we watched one a couple of weeks ago about the making of Halloween and really sort of the rise of John Carpenter as a director. But do you know what the budget for Halloween was?
Well, that's why everybody was making those films, because they were so low. I mean,
Halloween sort of laid laid the groundwork for a lot of these stories. Do you know what the budget was?
Let's say less than half a mil.
Oh, $300,000.
That's the range.
They were told, you can make the movie, but it's got to be $300,000. And unlike a lot of other of these other films that are these iconic movies that are covered in this series, where they said, yeah, you know, you got $5 million. And they bring it in at $13 million, you know, before it goes berserk. Halloween came in on budget at $300,000, with, you know, the only star power in the thing was Donald Pleasance, who wasn't particularly happy about the role they had him in and what they were asking him to do. But it was work, and he was willing to do it. I hope he got a percentage, because I think it ended up making something like $100 million at the box office.
Well, yeah. I mean, independent movie making has been a real tricky business for a long time. Those movie theaters, they didn't mess around. They were monopolists because they were a cartel.
You saw some of this in the with the Scarlett Johansson lawsuit against Marvel or Sony about Black Widow, and that Disney had supposedly gained the release. You know, she had tried to get tried to have it, her contract said, look, you're going to release this in theaters, because that's where the big money was in terms of star power and drawing power. And Disney tried to game it so that they would release it in theaters, at least initially, but like a day later or something like that, put it out through their streaming service on television, she blew a gasket and sued him. She's one of the major faces in that franchise. It was the first big movie coming back after the lockdowns, and she sued him. There was a settlement paid up, and I don't know what the terms of the settlement were, but my understanding from reading the inside reports on it was that, you know, she got, in her settlement, she basically got what she would have had the movie been released on big screens and just stayed on big screens initially before it started streaming.
Well, they would screw people right and left. There was years ago, there was a dude who was considered one of the best directors, and he was on 60 Minutes talking about how he got paid. And he said, you know, they got several movies going on at the same time, so they can swing the overhead wherever they want to. So there's never a movie that's going to, quote, make money if somebody's getting a part of the net. I mean, he said he was in huge demand as a director, and every movie he made, he said he was smart enough to get enough up front, but he said he never got a dime from the net of a movie. They always managed to move enough. That's why when the first... when people started getting percentage of the gross, actually the first one who got a percentage of the gross was some lady in her 20s in silent film or something. But they started getting a percentage of the gross. They say, look, there's never going to be a net. I mean, so give us, you know, one of the oddest stories, I think the four main places, it was Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Universal, it was 20th Century Fox, and was it Republic? I think there was three or four major places, like in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and they were all run by Jewish guys that had grown up within like three blocks of each other in New York, were the same age, but they had never met in New York. Is that the oddest thing? they all somehow moved to California, and they came out of the same hood, didn't know each other, and they were, you know, virtually, with Sam Goldwyn and, I don't know who the other guys are who ran Universal, but, remember the movie Sunset Strip, when she went to see who'd she go see? Was it Sam Goldwyn? That was the what the hell was her name? The silent film star. And that was another dark movie. Ugh. But was it Gloria Swanson?
I believe that's right.
You know, she did was go every night. She'd go down and watch her old movies. This huge house on Sunset Boulevard or something. And was it William Holden ended up dead in the swimming pool? That's another one. It's a great movie. You watch it once, you know, you can't watch it.
Yeah, because you want to kill yourself when you come out. And it's like, what's the most recent one that I've absolutely detested? Manchester by the Sea. I just came out of the theater going, you know, this is the kind of thing that, that you know, makes serial murderers.
Yeah,
Anyway.
I kind of felt the same way watching that movie.
Well, I mean, the one that had the more advancements in cinema, if you look at the way they did shootings and shoot how they shot the camera, whatever it is, how they filmed the damn thing, was A Clockwork Orange. I don't know how you watched that once, let alone twice.
That was a tough one to watch,
actually,
too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough one, but that actually, that ranks up there in one of my, probably my top 10 films. Because I had read the book, by Anthony Burgess, and the book was fascinating, and he, the creativity of the author in putting that language of these guys together. Of course, it was Russian, so I loved that. But the cleverness of the way they referred to it. So for example, the language in the book, and I think they refer to it in the movie, is called the Nazit language. And when I first heard it, I thought there was just some gibberish word, but then I realized what they had done is they had taken the suffix that's added to numbers when you count in Russian to get into the teens. So 3 is 3 in Russian, but 13 is 13. Четыре is 4 in Russian, but четырнадцать is 14. And so the Nazit language became the teen language of this bunch of thugs in their teens. I thought that was brilliant, and I actually thought Kubrick did a really good job on that. But good Lord, what's his face? McDowell is he's a disturbing actor when he wants to be, and he was a full disturbing in that film.
Well, speaking of which, as a segue, a little bit of what's going on here in Chicago. I was talking to my speaking of
teen thugs.
Yeah, speaking of teen thugs, I was talking to my gang. Well, their gang, and I've been sort of invited in on Tuesday to a couple of attorneys to go to the Triple Eight. On Wednesday, there's a big group with one of the aging judges, and a bunch of judges come by, and everybody sits down and has a drink with the guy because they all love him.
Oh, great. Lawyer gangs.
Yeah.
That's all you need in Chicago.
Well, they do, the judge, this is the judge that Tony Preckwinkle tried to throw out because she said that her friend Kim Fox didn't do a very good job. And who was the rapper, Manny? The guy that said he was arrested or did something where he got mugged and he didn't. He was, and he wasn't.
He's an actor, not a rapper.
Smollett.
Yeah, Jesse Smollett.
Well, this was the judge that they made him like the special prosecutor because they know he's very honest, and he came out and said she did a horse bleep job. So Tony Preckwinkle wanted everybody to vote no on the retention ballot, which of course nobody did because they liked the guy. Anyway, so he's kind of one of the group, but one of the dudes is telling me he does all this criminal law. He said, everybody talks about these gangs in Chicago. He said, it's not like, I mean, the gang, everybody thinks it's synonymous with, like, the Blackstone Rangers. He said, it's not. There's no leadership here. There's nobody you can talk to and say, look, lay off the kids at this high school, you know, or else. And he said,
there used to be.
Yeah, because now it's all these roving gangs of you know, 15 and 16-year-olds and 17 with basically no central. You know, the lady who got we'll get a load of this. Chicago police lady she's being charged with discharge of a weapon.
Oh, I saw that case.
Well, that's right in the parking lot. That's the Sam's Club right near where my mom used to live, right where my brother lives. And it's everybody in Beverly. That's a very busy place. It's right between Beverly, which is a nice neighborhood in Chicago, and Evergreen Park, which is a nice neighborhood in Evergreen Park. And so this gang of five people run up, and they kind of mess with her at the trunk, and then three guys hop in and take off in her car. So she's a Chicago police. Now, why, you know, she pulls out a gun and shoots after him. Of course, she misses the car by 50 feet, which is, you know, that's such a good thing. But
back to training.
Yeah, back to training. And now they're going to arrest her for illegal discharge of a weapon. Now, meanwhile, my friend from Notre Dame's wife who got killed on the Ryan, they let those guys go because even though she's dead and because it was, what is it, the something co-combatants or something? That they were shot at first, and they were returning fire, and she just happened to be in the middle. Yeah, we can't charge them.
It's called mutual combat, and we talked about this.
Yeah,
there's absolutely
so,
no application in either of those situations.
But so now this lady's going to get charged I mean, it's not the brightest thing in the world is to shoot at a fleeing car. Of course, it is your car, so if you hit it, it's you're only doing damage to your own property. But you know, so but those kids are that's the those are the gangs now. And I'm, and you mentioned the Clockwork Orange. I mean, those that don't know, it was all about can you take people that are absolutely, you know, seemingly outside of the moral culture everybody else has, and can you rehabilitate them? What do you have to do? Now, I don't. Well, the other gangs were, you know, that did the drugs and the other stuff. At least there was a, there was some logic to the system. I mean, there was something.
Well, two things. Number one, you know how they solved the gang problem in A Clockwork Orange, if you remember. They made them policemen.
Really?
That's yes. Right. Yeah, that's one of the brilliant themes of that book, and Kubrick does a great job in putting it out there when the protagonist, McDowell's character, steps, you know, gets released, and he's been conditioned so that any violence causes him to be, any move toward the violent action because it causes him to become violently ill, and he runs into a bunch of his buddies, who are cops, and they beat him senseless because he's helpless. He can't fight back. But the moral of the story is that if you can't manage or control the violence of these people by repressing it, you put them in positions where they can express it. You make them members of the state. You know, if you can't beat them, join them, and or if you can't beat them, hire them. And that was one of the brilliant parts of that movie. Anyway, that's one thing. The other issue that you're talking about, of course, is we're still seeing the fallout of Jody Weiss's, I thought, brilliant program that got interrupted mid-stride because of Rahm Emanuel's election and the fact the police union couldn't stand the guy. But Jody Weiss was the police superintendent whose anti-gang strategy basically resulted in the bust-up of the major gangs in Chicago. He decapitated that gang leadership, arrested them, threw them in jail, and the end result was chaos. And they never, you know, he got fired before the second part of that plan, which was to try to come in and have the police fill that vacuum of criminal leadership by getting control of these areas, which were no longer under control of the gangs, these four or five major gangs. And instead of that happening, what you ended up with was, you know, the rise of these quasi little emperors operating in, you know, two, three, four blocks of territory, and then them all fighting with each other and shooting each other to try to get more, you know, more territory. And apparently that's continuing to this day. I mean, it
was worse.
The situation when I left Chicago 5 years ago. It sounds like it's still going on.
Oh, it's way worse. It's way worse because the fighting is taking place in neighborhoods that aren't theirs, which is even worse. But
let me shift gears briefly in terms of shooting people to talk about the trial going on in Kenosha, just north of Chicago, with this Rittenhouse kid who, you know, is now in the middle of, they've got jury selected and are now, now moving through the evidence. And it's fascinating to me, and I don't want to rehash the self-defense issue. When I saw the video, my immediate reaction was that this was a clear case of self-defense, and you couldn't really get a much clearer case of self-defense. But, you know, much like your Chicago cop who, you know, is carjacked, and has the means to deal with it. This kid is attacked and has the means to deal with it, and instead of being hailed as a guy who actually exercised pretty good gun discipline with his rifle, is now facing, you know, what, two murder charges and reckless display of a firearm and attempted murder and a bunch of other things that, you know, it's crazy, and it's going to look like crazy when, as the trial goes on. It now turns out that the detective who was, so catch this, that there are a bunch of official things here going on that make this look really strange. Catch this, Chief. You have a triple or a double homicide in the middle of a race riot, effectively, a Black Lives Matter riot up in Kenosha, where, you know, it's like the third day, I think, of rioting. It's gotten national attention. You have a guy who shows up, you know, ostensibly to help defend property. He's armed. And he gets attacked. He shoots and kills two guys and blows, almost shoots the arm off a third. This case gets, and it's all on video. It's all been videotaped of what he's doing, or videotaped. It's been recorded on cameras and cell phones and everything. So this is notoriety central. Do you assign this case to your most experienced detective for purposes of investigation because of the profile of the case and the national publicity that it's received?
You would think so.
Yeah. The guy they assigned had been on the job for, I think, less than 2 years at the time he picked up the case and was assigned the case. It's crazy that would happen. So that's one little revelation that's going on there. It makes you wonder if, in fact, he was selected because he would have been very pliable for the prosecutor to manipulate in terms of what they were doing, what they were uncovering. It also turns out now that, and it's a lot more detail coming out about the FBI's surveillance program over cities with aircraft that was going on and has been going on for a while. The FBI has a fleet of, you know, I think it's 50 aircraft, many of which are owned through shell corporations to disguise their actual ownership and use, because, you know, this is moderately alarming to a lot of people to have aerial surveillance over the cities by law enforcement. I don't know why I would expect that, but in any event, so these planes are equipped with low light cameras, infrared cameras, and normal optics, and they can operate, you know, for hours over city, and they've got huge fields of view, and they can take in, you know, 20, 30, 40 blocks at a time as they fly. They also have a cell phone scanning feature that allows the operator and they're like giant vacuum cleaners. They just fly above and they record everything. And one of the things they record is all cell phone activity within, I don't know, you know, miles of the aircraft. That allows them not only to record phone calls, but to, if they need to or if they want to, but it also allows them to identify and locate cell phones and locate individuals and match those locations to the images on the video that they record. So that's come in. Interestingly enough, that video, they've got several kinds of video that they record, but one of them is high definition video that gives a lot of detail. And for whatever reason, the FBI erased that video of the shooting. I don't understand how that works. But
Loaders, we have to continue after the break, because let's just continue. SP Futures up 7, NASDAQ Futures up 62. I'll talk a little bit about Mr. Powell's speech yesterday and where we're heading there. And Lou, everything we talk about kind of comes to the same conclusion. We seem to have people incompetent at every level, and I don't quite know what that's all about. But anyway, we'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Harrell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now.
Right now. Well, we'll pick Stash Jacks. I'm Tom Allies, Mr. Matt Weber on the board. SP futures up 775, and NASDAQ futures up 63. Dow's actually down 5. So we're a mix, but we can't not go up with the money pouring into the system. It's yesterday I looked, Maddie and Lou, the amount of margin loans has gone from $768 billion at the beginning of the year to $903 in the last 10 months. Margin loans on stock. So you wonder where all this money's coming from. It's being borrowed on top of everything else. DAX up 83.5%. FTSE up 33 cents. I guess we'll call that one flat. 33 cents. Wow. CAC around up 26. That's 0.4% over in Asia. Nikkei up 273.9%, Shanghai up 28.8%, Hang Seng up 200.8%. Is Powell's performance yesterday, and the Federal Reserve basically said we're going to keep going. So we are, I guess. Yesterday the Dow was up 104, S&P up 30, NASDAQ futures up 161. The bonds 1.57, that's right where they were. The Bund minus 0.18, and again that has dropped pretty dramatically in the last week. You made it back to minus 0.08. Japan pretty much unchanged at positive 0.08. Oil up $1.53, $82.39. Brent up $1.60, $83.59. Natural gas down 3 cents to $5.63. RBOB up 4 cents, $2.37. It was down 4, now it's back up 4. Gold up $15.50 to $17.79. It's up a bunch, but it's right back to where it was. So it was down during the day yesterday. Silver down up 54 cents, $23.78. I don't think I've ever seen a commodity in the last 2 or 3 years is violently moves between 22 and 24, yet never breaks out. Just a violent move in basically a 10% range. It's crazy. Copper up 5 cents, 437. And we've got Bitcoin down from 1,496 bucks to 61,500. Maddie, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports, a lot of sports.
37 minutes past the hour. Good morning to everyone out there. We have a couple of issues already this morning, which is not how you want to start your Thursday, but there's a crash on the inbound Dan Ryan just before the I-55 circle there that's blocking the left lane, and that's causing some delays as you're heading into downtown from the south side. No issues on the Bishop Ford or I-57. Traffic building on the Stevenson near Cicero in Midway, but no accidents to report. Eisenhower looking good so far. We also have a crash on the Kennedy. This is on the inbound side at Harlem coming in from the northwestern suburbs. There's a crash that's been moved to the right shoulder, but it's causing a bit of a slowdown as folks navigate around that. No issues on the Edens, though, and Lakeshore Drive is quiet in both directions. Off the expressways, Route 83, which is Kingery Highway, right at Riverside Drive, there's an accident with extrication, it says, so not good, with emergency crews on the scene. That's out west, and that happened, looks like, about 20 minutes ago, so that's a bad scene. And then further west, out in Wheaton, looks like Roosevelt Road is closed between Route 59 and Neitner Boulevard due to construction right now, and it doesn't say when that's going to end, but that's going to cause some confusion, as that's a pretty busy area at Roosevelt and Route 59. Everything else looking good out there. Weather today, similar to what it's been all week. Lots of sunshine, but cold temperatures. A high of just 47 today before we warm up for the weekend. Right now it is crystal clear and 36 degrees downtown. For our Phoenix listeners, sunshine with a high of 89. Right now it's clear and 60. In sports, the Bulls fell behind by 18, stormed back in the fourth quarter, and actually tied the game late before falling in Philadelphia to the 76ers, 103-98. It was the Bulls' first road loss of the season, dropping them to 6-2 on the year. Blackhawks had a 3-2 lead heading into the third period, only to give up two goals to Carolina as they lost at home to the Hurricanes 4-3. Blackhawks are the worst team in the NHL right now. Lastly, college football, NIU was in a shootout last night against Kent State and came up just short. They fell to Kent State 52-47.
Chief. So what's the line on the Mudville Nines game tonight?
Well, we are 4-0 after a couple of rainouts, and our opponent, I believe, is 3-2. So it should be, actually, I'd have to look at our schedule. We have two games left. One of them is versus a 3-2 team. One of them's versus a 4-1 team. I can't remember if tonight we play the 4-1 or the 3-2. But either way, we're playing a good team, good solid team, and should be tough. It's going to be cold out there. But looking forward to wrapping up the last two games of the regular season and heading into the playoffs before the snow comes.
So do you have your issued Stocks and Jacks long underwear?
It could probably call for it tonight. It's going to be, we play at 7:25, so obviously, you know, about 2 hours after the sun goes down, it's going to be chilly. It'll be in the low to mid 40s.
I think it's supposed to be calm wind, so you should be all right with that at least.
Yeah.
So, Lou, the enormity of what is going on, and this thing going on in Wisconsin, and I don't really know the particulars as much as you do, but I look at what is going on there and what the amount of, shall we say, resources it takes in one of these profile cases, and how long it takes to get the thing going and through the mill. And I'm looking at the Hey Jackass stuff here in Chicago, and there's 3,900 people shot year to date in Chicago. So let's see,
that's unbelievable. Although it's probably not the highest per capita number in the United States, but that's a lot of shootings.
It's pretty close. There's a couple of, there's probably some smaller towns where maybe some drug interdiction points or something, but now 85% or so of these things don't even have a suspect. So how exactly, when you had, you know, COVID shut down, there was my lawyer buddies told me they were doing as late as a few weeks ago, they were doing two jury trials a week at 26 in California. And the federal courts aren't open yet, which is mind-boggling. Our employees don't work. I mean, whatever we got going on in government, it's seriously messed up. And like you were saying, the response to this stuff. Now, how would we even try 1,000 people? Suppose we caught a third of these guys. That'd be 25%. How do you put 1,000 people through a jury trial system? With all the crap that's going on up in Kenosha now, these wouldn't all be high-profile cases, but Lou, it is.
Well, the impact shows up in. I mean, again, I follow a number of sites in Chicago that give updates on just the stupidity that's going on in Chicago criminal justice system in Cook County. So this latest one, five-time felon charged with stealing loads of cigarettes from Walgreens stores. While out on bail for stealing loads of cigarettes from another Walgreens store. At a time when he was on bail for stealing cigarettes from yet another Walgreens store.
What is he like? Why is he like Walgreens?
Yeah, does CVS not sell cigarettes? They might not actually.
I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
No,
it's so surreal, and it very much looks like a Clockwork Orange. And I realize our violent crime rates are not where they were, you know, in the late 80s. But they're getting there. And the mentality of prosecutors like Ms. Fox and Bowden in San Francisco and, you know, a number of other folks in the large cities, where they say, we don't want to charge people because if we charge them, it means that we just put more young black men or young Hispanic men in jail. And we don't want to do that. You know, it's a part of the systemic racism of our system, and you know, the response of any normal person would be, but they're guilty.
Yeah.
You know, it's not it's not a question of incarcerating innocent people. We're locking up guilty guys. We got the guys on video shooting each other outside the house. We got the guys on video having the gunfight in their car. We recover the car after it crashes with the people in it. So it's not a question of, gee, maybe we're too aggressive in throwing people in jail because of bad evidence. It's no, we're going to turn those guys loose, and yet a 17-year-old who is attacked and defends himself, we're going to spend the time and money to hang that guy.
Well, it doesn't make any sense.
Just to be clear on this, Chicago is 10th in the country in murder rates per capita.
Okay.
It's about almost three times worse in St. Louis. St. Louis is the worst by far. It's really bad there. Baltimore 2nd, New Orleans 3rd, Detroit 4th, Cleveland 5th, Las Vegas 6th, Kansas City 7th, Memphis 8th, Newark, New Jersey 9th, and then Chicago 10th, just ahead of Cincinnati, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Tulsa, and Pittsburgh. So
I bet we're better at pitching people back up. They don't die.
That's what I was going to say. I think that may reflect the capability of Chicago's emergency medical facilities.
There's something to that, although I'm sure these cities are pretty darn good at it, too.
Well, we had 3,944 people shot. Only 682 died.
Yeah, but I'm sure those percentages are the same in all these cities, I would think. But either way, it doesn't make it less bad here, but I just wanted to put it into context. St. Louis is really, really bad. They're like third world right now.
St. Louis is down to like 290,000 people.
Yeah, and they have almost 70 murders per 100,000 people in 2021. And Chicago only has 24, which is still bad, but nowhere near 70.
Isn't it like the worst in the world is it what's the place in Venezuela? Isn't that the worst? Their capital?
Yeah,
Caracas or something.
If you do international cities, Chicago isn't even close.
we're not in the, you know, there are places in Africa and South America that are just horrific.
Well, but Louis, what you're sort of noticing, I mean, I do. I mean, again, this is a sample of one.
Right now, Tijuana, Mexico is number one.
Wow.
134 murders per 100,000 people.
Wow.
I mean, that's...
That's cartel. That's cartel stuff. It's Miami in the 80s when the, again, much like we were talking about, you have turf wars and control and... people settle everything with their shooting.
Yeah, the only good news about that was we got to watch Miami Vice.
Yeah, the top five cities in the world are all in Mexico. Tijuana, Juarez, Unipan, Irapuato. Of course, I'm probably saying these bad. And then Obregion.
Where is that?
In Mexico. And then the worst non-Mexican city is Caracas, Venezuela, like Chief said. And then St. Louis is the worst American city, as we mentioned. They're the 9th worst in the world.
By the way, you have a prosecutor in St. Louis who is right out of the Kim Fox handbook.
Well,
same particular outlook, elected with the same mechanism, funding mechanism that supported Fox and the guy in San Francisco and the guy in L.A. and Seattle, and it's. It's really going to the ramifications of those programs are stunning, but totally unsurprising, as I said, to any normal person.
But what you're seeing is, and I think you're seeing it up and down right now. And I mean the politics. I can't help but bring the politics involved into this, because when I say the politics, I'm not talking right or left. I'm talking about the general, to me. I mean, again, we grew up on the South Side in Catholic schools and so forth, but I you drive around here and these, you look at these morons that are running the city and all these shootings on the expressways. Well, they've got more cameras they put on. We got more cameras than we don't know what to do with. Yet, if you drive down the expressway, like I did Sunday night coming back to my brother's, I'm going to say two cars went by me a minimum 110. And I was going 70 and they shook the Suburban. I mean, it was like I was parked and somebody went by in a highway. So that was a difference in speed. And some other guy realized they were going over 100 and he takes off. And you can ride these expressways all day long and you never see a policeman. Never. Unless there's an accident. They won't pull somebody over. Then you get off the expressway. Everybody is blowing through stop signs, red lights. I mean, it is absolute mayhem here. It's worse than Boston was. When, you know, there they used to take that as pride when they drive in Boston. Nobody went for red light. But it's all up and down the line. Nobody pays any attention to any law at all. Because you
interesting story out of on this route out of Vegas, and Maddie can look this one up. But I think one of the Vegas Raider players was arrested DUI for going 156 miles an hour.
He killed two people.
He killed a person and a dog. It was a woman and her dog. And
dog. Sorry.
Yeah, he was going. He was almost twice the legal limit in Vegas drinking, obviously. And 156 miles per hour. And somehow he survived, and the person he was with survived, and yet he kills a 23-year-old woman and her dog. And he was obviously immediately released by the Raiders, and now he's facing up to 20 years, from what I read.
Well, if the policeman...
Interesting turn on that. Do you remember I think it was Little, right? Leonard Little, the defensive tackle, really good defensive tackle,
right,
for the Rams?
Yep.
Who was involved, I think he killed... Yes. He had a drunk driving incident, and nothing happened to him. And then he had a second one and killed, I think he killed one person. And, you know, he continued to play. The NFL, this was back before the NFL. I mean, his case was one of the ones that people pointed to in terms of the NFL having to get better control of its players outside of work. But, he continued to play. And I thought that was a really interesting, because I was an agent at the time, and I was thinking, Matt, that's some good agent work. But the short answer was, if you're a really good football player, they're going to try to hang on to you.
Well, there was a series here in the Sun-Times. We just started the show, and they were talking about people who went to court who would have their licenses suspended either for, not so much drunk driving, because I think they're pretty handy on that, but you know, for going over 100 and things like that. And how many of these people walked out of the court? They drove to court and parked in the court parking lot on a suspended license. Talk about thumbing your nose at the law enforcement system. I mean, but we're talking about, you know, we have to say a little bit about this. We had the Fed guy comes on yesterday, and in my mind, I keep saying this every time these guys talk. I've never heard a performance like that. And all the guys on CNBC afterward, man, the guy. He put the arrow right on the dot. I mean, did everything just right. Said just what he needed to say, not disturbing the markets. God's sake, Lou, the guy looked like he was nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room of rocking chairs. I mean, he knew he was up there lying. You could tell by his body language. Oh, now, the only thing we didn't expect is, like, all this inflation. We've got it now, but don't worry. It's only going to be, like, for a little while, and then we have all the tools in the world to adjust it. For God's sake, Lou, do we honestly think that if we're going to have then he admitted to being at 5.5% or something. Okay, which, and then some other people now are saying 7. I'm thinking it's more like 10 or 11. Does he honestly think that like a raising the discount rate, the federal funds rate, 0.25% like in January is going to make, I mean, what are these guys on? What is the motivation behind this stuff? You can't do your job because
the motivation is to protect your empire, protect your bosses, keep your job. I'm going to wax a little bit here with a rant. Not that you guys have ever heard me rant.
No.
So I'm involved right now in litigation against the federal government involving the COVID vaccine. And I'm working with attorneys on a case. We're trying to deal with one of the mandates that have come down. So in tracking all this, you know, that we move for an injunction and the government files its response. And so the government files its response. And one of the things that jumps out at you when you do litigation is you start working your way back through what government agencies, when you're suing the government, what government agencies will say and do in the course of a lawsuit. We sort of have this ideal in our heads of federal agencies like the Center for Disease Control or the National Institute of Health or the EPA or whomever, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF. we have in our mind the fact that these people are operating in a sort of quasi-neutral way to the extent that they follow the data. But their job is to, you know, these are our versions of the philosopher kings. They're experts on the subject matter. They study it and they give you their best opinion. And our political leadership is supposed to take that information and then work it up into a public policy. What you find instead is this incredible, and I'll use the word conspiracy, among government agencies to support the political establishment with whatever false or misleading presentation of the data that they can arrange. So, to cite an example that comes up in the COVID, and COVID is rife with this stuff, that comes up in the COVID context. At some point in the development of the vaccine, the Center for Disease Control becomes aware that, and early on, you know, within say a month of the licensing, and there was a licensing of a vaccine. It's not available in the United States yet, but FDA did license a vaccine. It's called Comirnaty, and it's not here. You can't find it. In fact, if you go on the FDA's website and look at Comirnaty in the description for it, they don't even have a label, an approved label for it yet, up on the website. So whatever that stuff is, it's not here. Instead, we're all using this emergency use authorization vaccine developed by Moderna or Pfizer or whomever. So it becomes apparent to CDC, without telling anybody, that in fact the vaccine is not stopping transmission of the disease and it's not immunizing people against catching it. That in fact what the vaccine is doing is mitigating illness in most people and reducing the effects, but it's not stopping the spread and it's not preventing people from catching it, from developing the disease. So what do? Somebody at the CDC looks around and goes, you know what? We've got some definitions in our website that a clever person who reads them could look at and say, well, this isn't really a vaccine and you're not really engaged in a vaccination program. Because your definition of vaccine and vaccination up until 2015 was use of a biologic product typically made up of dead cells or a dead version of the virus or the target that you're trying to prevent, that's then put into somebody to develop immunity. I rewrote that definition in 2015, but basically said that this is a vaccine is a biologic or a drug developed to be administered that will provide you with immunity against a particular disease.
Well, so now in their definition, now a flu shot's a vaccine, even though it really isn't.
Well, so if somebody wakes up and says, this is not helping, we could find, so a clever person will be able to turn this against us and say, these aren't really vaccines. So what do? They don't come out and talk about, look, the vaccine that we're getting for COVID is not really a vaccine under our definition because it doesn't prevent spread or catching the disease. It just protects you from the effects. So it's not really a vaccine. They don't want to say that because politically that would damage the people who are in charge, who have been saying vaccine over and over again. So what do? On September 1, they rewrite the definition. They don't announce it. They do it very quietly. They just come in and they withdraw the definition that talks about immunity and they put in a definition that says a vaccine is a substance given to you that protects you from the disease. It's so generic it's almost meaningless in terms of what a vaccine and a vaccination is under CDC law. But this is an example of, and when you go into court with this kind of information, the judges look at you in most cases like, what are you talking about? These people are out here doing their job. I give a lot of deference to what the CDC says or the FDA says with respect to their area of expertise, the development of drugs or whatever. You know, they're not going to lie to us. And of course, the short answer is yes, they do. And not only do they lie to us, they lie to us in misleading and very hard to detect ways unless you get into the weeds. And these are difficult stories to report because they're complicated and they're hard to reduce to a soundbite, as you just witnessed. And so this now permeates our federal executive structure where I'd said on the show for more than, a year that I did not trust Dr. Fauci because of my dealings with him and with NIH in the anthrax vaccine litigation, where these folks would say literally anything to support the DOD's position that vaccine was properly licensed. We are seeing the same thing here, albeit in a slightly different form, where if you go out on the street and you ask somebody, I mean, my health provider, Cigna, sends me a letter saying there's a licensed and approved vaccine available. And I called up their customer service people and I said, that is a lie. And you guys should know better. And this vaccine is not licensed. And they said, well, it's functionally the same. I said, but that's not licensed.
What's the term? It's a chemical equivalent is the term they're using, right?
Yeah, but it's not even a chemical equivalent because the FDA just issued a statement on October 29th saying, oh, by the way, remember when we said it was chemically equivalent? It's really not. There are ingredients in the licensed vaccine that aren't in this stuff that we're putting out here. Now, the FDA says they don't make any difference, but my response to that is you were the guys that told us it was chemically the same. So now that's not true either.
Well, Lou, when you talk about this kind of communication, I noticed this. I mean, we only got 30 seconds here, but when I was on a trading floor, when you traded against people who were their own people, when you had an out trade, it was a very honest discussion, and probably you ended up splitting it because you believed the other person knew what they knew, and you knew what you knew, and everybody had a good reputation, so you would just split it and say, well, it's just what happens. As soon as people got to be employees of somebody else, you had to, go to their boss on an out-trade. I said, you weren't here. I didn't trade with you. But at the CBOE, which was a really good organization, it's been in the private sector, it's been like that forever, Lou. People who would never lie to you on the golf course and steal your $5, if they thought their company was, they would lie to you for a second for their company. I mean, and the communication is so bizarre. It's almost like there's a pheromones or there's a wind of something. People seem to know just how they're supposed to answer without even being told. And this is at a good corporation. I can only imagine what it's like at a bad one or in the city hall or someplace. I mean, if you don't toe the party line, you're out in a second.
Yeah. So this is. And you saw this with FDA. You saw the three major, I think three senior FDA officials, vaccine officials, who resigned at the end of August over the booster shot issue, supposedly. Who said, we're not going to get up and stand up and say boosters are good or that they're even licensed. This incredible pell-mell rush to vaccinate even children when there is no, the threat to children from COVID is almost non-existent. But the push is coming from the political side of the house and the people that, as I said, we have typically relied on and certainly the courts rely on to give us a neutral, unbiased, scientifically based assessment are not, in fact, trustworthy enough to do that. I used to put it down to incompetence. I think it's malevolence.
Next week,
and I realize that cuts against my normal rule, which is never attribute to malevolence what you can attribute to incompetence. I'm starting to lean toward malevolence.
Why don't we have Maddie make a little note, and then next week we talk about that because that's what I look back at some of these things that have happened in the economic sphere, even going back 100 years, and I used to think it was just people were all doing the things for all the right reasons that just ended up making a mistake or things didn't work out the way they did. Now I'm convinced it was all, just virtually every single time, it was premeditated. I'm getting the same.
I don't want to sound like a conspiracy guy.
I'm just saying the same thing going on with the Fed right now. They know who's winning and they know who's losing with this pumping money into the system, and the people who are winning are controlling them. The other 90%. But we got a dash, bud. SP Futures up 7, NASDAQ Futures up 65. Be right back, Mr. Dan Janitas.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices, along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control!
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
There's something happening here.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Holly, Mr. Weber on the board. S&P Futures up 775, NASDAQ Futures up 66. We cannot go down. We wouldn't dare, or somebody's going to buy some money. A guy like Dan Janitas gets a call from the Fed. They say, Dan, buy $20 billion worth of stock. And Dan picks up the phone and does it.
That must be nice.
Must be nice.
Yeah.
How are you, buddy?
Yeah, it was certainly a good move for the market. You know, it was good news for the market yesterday. And, you know, we saw that, and, you know, the market was, you know, down 100, and you know, the Dow, I should say, was down 100, and, you know, kind of had a movement to plus 100 after the news came out. So it was good news. Some people may or may not know, the bond buying taper will begin in mid-November, which means that the Fed is going to reduce the amount of its purchases by a total of 15 million. 10 million U.S. treasuries, 10 million less in U.S. treasuries, 5 million less in mortgages. And this will continue for 8 months, and the tapering should be through by June. So that's the plan. And I think the market likes that. I like that, certainly. I've been talking about this for a while, that it's necessary. Their pace is still, to me, a little bit conservative, but it's certainly going to be beneficial to the market, and we need to get some of this excess out of the market at this point, I think, to keep stability. The question then becomes, in June, what happens? At that point, there'll be $9 trillion in the balance sheet. $8.4 trillion are going to be bonds, and one possibility is that they would just let the bonds mature. So that's good news for all of us, and actually good news for people who want to, you know, the bond market took it positively as well with a steepening of the yield curve. You know, the 30-year now at 2%, you know, it had been below 2% in anticipation. And the good news is as we talked last week about the yield curve flattening, showing signs of potential slowdown in growth, when the yield curve steepens, that means that the bond market is seeing continued growth. So it's, you know, good news, absolutely. The other good news for us, because on the equity side, we do tend to buy more small micro-cap names, and they've been rallying recently. It's been a risk-on trade, and this just continued yesterday. We saw some nice movement in our small-cap names.
Why should we stop there? Why shouldn't we just run the money supply up 50% and everything double again, and we'll all be rich, right?
You know, that's, I agree with you, you know, on that, but, you know, the people making these decisions are, you know, being very, you know, being quite conservative at this point. So, you know, they claim that they're not following, they claim that they're not being responsive.
are reactive, and I don't agree. I think they are being somewhat reactive. I think they waited maybe just a little long, you know, in terms of inflation. The other thing is the inflation, you know, that I don't totally agree with Powell's comments on inflation. The inflation he's saying is transitory, although I think part of it may be transitory. I do think going back to where the inflation becomes an issue is on the employment side. And I do think there will be continued upward pressure on wages. I think that's going to continue into next year. And although it may be, we might be at the peak of this, you know, demand for workers, or lack of workers, if you will, in this environment that's causing problems in the supply chain, I do believe that the supply chain will improve over time. I do believe people will be going back to work. However, I don't think it's going to happen without an increase in benefits and wages. And that, I think, is going to be stickier in the long run on the inflation side, because I think that's what we've been looking for years, is some upward movement in wage inflation, and that's, I do think that's sticky. I don't think that's transitory.
One quick question, because we're going to get into what we should actually be investing in here, because obviously we should be doing something. Why do you believe these guys at all? If you'd have put this, I use the term buffoon, to take the last 18 months and every other month take excerpts of his press conference to where 18 months ago there was zero inflation, not even a thought of it. They couldn't even get to their 2%. Then it was, well, we might be coming close to our 2%. Then don't worry, it's transitory. And yesterday he must have said five times, we have way more inflation. He's been wrong every single month. Or he hasn't been wrong. He's been lying to us, one or the other. As I age, I don't know which is worse. Do I want somebody to be that wrong in that position, or do I want to be lied to? I don't know which is worse.
Well, the following thing, I mean, a good thing for people like us who have been in the market, in the business for so long, is that we know when, you know, we know when they're not being totally upfront, or more importantly, we know when they're wrong, because they are wrong sometimes. I still use the example of going back to December a few years ago where they were clearly wrong and the market didn't like it. I think we had like a short-term correction of close to 20% at that point. People thought this was the beginning of the downturn. It really was basically a mistake by the Fed. So I think investors are paying more attention, like us, are paying more attention to this, and really being a little more skeptical of what they say. Not only that, also kind of having our own opinion. Like I said, my opinion being wage inflation is still going to be an issue.
Well,
in other words,
that's
a big component. So I don't totally agree with the comments.
Well, plus, I mean, the idea that, I mean, you're right, if you could believe these guys, the idea that they're cutting back a certain amount, I think it's a little light on the cutback, but what would possess anyone? I mean, I know that, you know, when you and I have an adult beverage, I think you'll, the idea that we can hold this guy's feet to the fire for $10 billion a week, 2 weeks ago went up 85. In one week. I mean, it's supposed to be 135 a month right now. Who's keeping an eye on whether it's 135? Who the hell knows whether it's going to be 125 next month? What if it's not? What if it's 140? What do we do? Fire them? We should maybe. But I mean, why does anybody even think that it even makes it? I mean, it's like one of us peeing in the backyard pool. I mean,
right.
You know, I mean, what, I mean, how would anybody even know that he's going to cut back $5 billion when there's a month where he'll do like 180? I mean, I don't even know how could you possibly, plus he won't give you the money supply numbers anymore. I mean, how does anybody even know whether he's doing what he says he's going to do?
Yeah, and I think more of it, as you're saying this, I'm thinking that more and more of this is really more not being right and trying to hedge your bets and trying to be, So I agree. Maybe not quite as skeptical as you in terms of them. You know, who's going to hold their feet? It's going to be when the market starts responding negatively because they don't believe what's going on, and then they're going to kind of have to wake up. Or when inflation starts picking up more, we start seeing increases in from here in other supplies and goods beyond food and gas. You know, and the consumer starts seeing that. I think that's so. I see, like I said, my feeling about these guys all along has been that they've been responsive or reactive rather than being proactive. So I'm confident that they'd be reactive. You know, will it be too late? I don't know. I don't think so, but I agree with you. I don't like this back and forth or having to wait each period of time to see what's being done. I like what the plan that they have ahead. I think it's a good plan. I think, like you said, it's kind of light, but, you know, I think that will definitely, it has improved the tone of the market, and, you know, I'm not sure who the advisors are that, to them who are talking about how the markets work, but, you know, maybe you and I should be, you know, putting our 2 cents in.
Well, they wouldn't want to hear us. I mean, right now
they wouldn't want to, but I think it would be good for them to hear us.
Well, but right now nobody wants the market going down. So whatever, right. I'm sure they spent hours at this meeting saying, what can we say to where we won't disturb the markets? And they did. They said exactly that. But if these guys get, what happens if, I hope I'm wrong, but what if we get if the people at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, even though they know the party line, what if they come out with a 1% number in February, March, and April? And we're going to have this buffoon telling us he's going to raise rates from 0.5% to 0.75%, and it's going to make a difference? I mean, 3.5% is neutral.
I absolutely agree with you.
I don't want any of my people's stock to go down, right? I mean, obviously that's my living, and it is yours as well. But do I think that it's their job to maintain some stock at 100 times revenue? I don't know that it is. I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's going to end up being a bad thing. I mean, I looked at the margin loans yesterday. We were up from $768 billion to $903 in the last 10 months.
Yeah, I've actually had some inquiries from some clients to say, go, you know, keep going on the margin accounts to continue to add. And then I've actually had a couple that have made comments about the other, you know, kind of going the other way. If rates were to go up, that's certainly going to have an impact. But I hear you, and I would say that our style tends to do well in this environment because we're trying to be less correlated with either the bond market, you know, more like the Barclays aggregate, the bond aggregate, or the S&P. So we tend to buy names that don't have a lot of correlation with those markets and look really more at the underlying fundamentals of the companies and maybe, you know, looking at value when they've sold off.
Well, we've had a few people.
I do have a couple of ideas.
Well, let me run this one more thing by you. I'm just asking a question. If you hear anything, then I definitely want the ideas. We had a few people, you know, I do stuff for different people like you guys do, and some of the people they've just had a couple stocks where they just couldn't justify them being at like the levels they are, and they've lightened up on some of them to where they've got a couple of clients, Dan, that were, we're talking about, you know, $2 and $3 million accounts that all of a sudden see $100,000 cash.
Right.
They're calling up inflamed. You know, what are you doing? I want to be all in. This market's going up every day. The Fed, it'll never go down. I mean, I'm some of the comments I'm hearing are scary. I mean, I don't know. Are you hearing the same thing?
I am. Yeah, no, I am definitely. And I think, you know, I keep saying, you know, sort of generally I keep saying that we've been in the markets for a long time. We've seen the ups and downs. We know that there's going to be a correction. It has to be a correction that's healthy. But younger people, for example, you know, who started in our business after 08, have only really seen things go in one direction.
Oh, yeah.
Same thing with people who own real estate. If you've been in a housing market that has just gone in one direction, you don't even consider the option of it not happening. So some people are telling me as well, put on the accelerator, and, you know, I have to, you know, tell them that this is maybe, you know, just continue to sort of stay where we're at, you know, and that's what we've done. And then maybe, you know, continue to look for new names that have value in here. But
so what do you got?
You know, it's not really the time to double down or, you know, to put on the accelerator any further.
Right. So what should we, we got a stack we don't like anymore. We sold it. We got some cash. What do we do with it?
Yeah, there's a couple of names that have come up. You know, we're talking about on the fixed income side, Southwestern Energy, and they just reported, numbers were great, really strong positive, free cash flow, which for a bond guy is great. Also, this company, what I like about this company is, they are focused on debt repayments. So they have, these bonds that are maturing, in March, that we own, that we've owned, you know, we've been full in on for a while. But they have some 5 3/8 bonds that are due in 2030.
These are the guys, the natural gas guys on the Northeast, right?
Southwestern is the one that is predominantly in the Appalachian region.
Yeah, so they're not really Southwest. They're sort of Northeast, but they're named Southwest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think they focused more on the Appalachian region. They've actually expanded. But what I was, the, you know, the bonds are okay, but I would even say take a look at the stock, which is trading around 5.
This is SWE.
So if you want to bang for the buck on this name, I know a lot of hedge funds have been buying it. It's a company that's going to weather any downturn, but we don't see any downturns coming up, and I think they're going to do well through this, you know, through the winter. So
what's the symbol?
A really good management team, and again, a management team focused on paying down debt, which both bondholders and equity and shareholders love.
What's the symbol? That's SWE?
SWN.
SWN. Yeah, I didn't think it was SW. SWE.
Yeah, SWN. And then the other name that we've talked about before as a recommendation on the, you know, on the preferred is Blue Knight, the asphalt storage company. And they, you know, they've continued to beat expectations. And they're also, you know, like I said, it's a cash flow business. It's a well-managed business. You know, the preferred has done extremely well. But the stock is actually down at about $3, a little over $3. And that's, I think, another name that is kind of overlooked. But they're in it for the long run. And, you know, kind of when things trade down, if you want to put a little into something that is, has upside potential, it probably won't be tied to the market. BKEP is the ticker. And, again, the same company that has the preferred outstanding.
Dan, what do you make of, with the rest of, the market kind of going crazy, and you'll see some stock that you wonder, like Bed Bath & Beyond the other day went up like, what, doubled or something? And I mean, the stuff is, you know, I'm going to say a little bit goofy to guys like us, but some of the stocks that have, seemingly are somewhat bulletproof, like some of the ones you've mentioned too, and I've got a couple that I watch myself. They're having trouble getting a bid. Like you say, they're down almost. I mean, to where they're good buys, but I mean, it's not, you could have a portfolio of 20 stocks here that aren't moving. I mean, some of the stuff in the oil patch is, some of the stuff isn't. I mean, you could be in Schlumberger, it's not going anywhere. I mean, there's a lot of places that you could be stuck and not be participating in the largesse, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, we got to remember that we're long-term investors, and people have to be patient with, if you like a company long-term, and we do, you know, we're research-driven, so we're looking at the fundamentals, and if we like a company long-term, the way the stock price trades is not necessarily indicative of how well the company is going to do in the future. So if you continue to like the company, if you like the company at 50 and it trades down at 40, you got to love it if nothing has changed, and then all of a sudden they come out with strong earnings like Aztec, ASTE, and they've kind of gradually drifted down. And this is definitely a pure infrastructure play. They're the ones that do they pave roads, they make the pavers. You know, they're the company I visited in Chattanooga recently. Their stock was up 8% yesterday. So those people who waited and were patient, you know, have done well. And those who we've been able to buy stock at a discount have done well. And I still like the company. I love the management team. So you got to think long term. You can't be too short term focused. One thing, as you know, and I'm sure you'll agree, that's happened over the years, and especially in the last decade, maybe even the last 5 years, even more so, this focus on the short term, this focus on these short term trading plays, and that while that's good for people, I mean, if it's your retirement money, you know, maybe take a piece of it and you can trade in and out, but really, you really have to look at the long term. Especially in retirement accounts and we like to find those names that are going to stick around. So yeah, I agree with you. Some stuff has been stuck in the mud and some stuff has actually traded off a little. But when you have a day like, yesterday, we've seen a lot of these names come back, or when earnings finally come out and, you know, that they wake up people. Wait a minute, this is a good company. Why did we pass on it, or why did we sell it too soon? So.
Well, yeah, I mean, the mentality is, I mean, you give a, you know, it's really, people may say, I mean, a lot of people may say, just give me either a market return or a solid return. I'm retired. You know, if I can do 6 or 7%, I'm happy. All of a sudden, you see a stock double, and the first question is, why wasn't I in it?
Right, absolutely. And there's another name that we've spoken about before. Again, thinking a little more speculative, a little less market. You know, they're not going to be focused on the market. Noble Energy, NE, ticker symbol NE, they did come out of a restructuring. And the stock initially traded up quite a bit, and then there were a bunch of investors that were in bond investors that were in the old bonds that had to sell out. Like PIMCO was the largest holder, and so it's a technical issue where the stock kind of has fluctuated up and down. It still wants to go higher. They announced selling four of their rigs the other day and gotten a really good price. Earnings are coming out tomorrow. This is a name I think the market's going to start focusing on more. Certainly the increase in oil prices has helped them greatly, and I think the realization that their industry is going to be around for a while. But it's a management team, again, that's focusing on, they've really done a terrific job in cleaning up their balance sheet, and it's a stock that...
Yeah, how did those guys, they were a name that we traded years ago, and then how did they get themselves in trouble? Is it just when the oil prices went flying down a year and a half ago or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, as oil prices dropped, that definitely hurt them. Certainly, they were part of the, they weren't necessarily helped when there was, they got clobbered when the Russians and the Saudis decided to, try to control the market and, what we saw last year where they were cutting production at a time when they shouldn't have been necessarily. So that was a big part of it. But this was a voluntary restructuring. It wasn't a mandatory. And they chose to do this as they had an opportunity at this point to really improve their balance sheet. And that's just, it's the way that some companies operate. It's not always, I don't always think it's the best idea, but in this case, they're in much better shape, much better competitive shape.
Yeah, they were, I won't say a high flyer, but they were, Time Machine, he's on the show years ago. He's always talking about these guys. And
absolutely. That them in Transocean.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Ticker symbol RIG, RIG. Yeah, that industry has gone through transition. It's gone through some consolidation. They've been part of that, but they've actually made some purchases as well. And I think there was the concern about how soon their business would become obsolete, but it's certainly not going to be anytime. In the next decade.
Dan, is there any traditional, when I say any, I mean, people can expand on the wells they have, which gets you to the same place, but is there still, drilling going on in the Gulf and stuff, or is it all the new stuff, all this fracking?
No, there's plenty of drilling going on in the Gulf and in the Middle East and then, up in Norway and, drilling is still, it's going on. In fact, there's been an increase surprisingly in recent years. I mean, we kind of saw a slowdown with the beginning of COVID, but things have gradually continued to increase. So, there's definitely been a demand and there's definitely been drilling.
All
of their rigs are out and active and,
you haven't seen a huge comeback in the Schlumbergers or the rigs in terms of they're obviously not as big as they used to be. I mean, or something. They're not as profitable. They've never come back. I mean, Schlumberger used to be $80.
Right. Yeah. There's been, it really kind of depends. You have to kind of look at the full mix of their, this is a pure play. Noble is pure play on drilling. They're just a rig company. That's all they do. Schlumberger has other businesses. Certain businesses will do well in certain environments. And I'm not sure that they have the top tier assets on the rig side. Noble does. The most technologically advanced, they can use them, and they're the most flexible in terms of moving them from location to location based on demand and
new. Well, that's a fascinating industry. I love it when you talk about it because when I used to go to those crazy money shows, I still have them, where you go to these shows and everything in the world you can invest in from trading cards to the coins to you name it, in those things. It was always a great people show, but I used to love going to oil and gas guys, because what a fascinating industry. I mean, would you know, that's why I love it when you talk about it, because there's places where you can drill, where you're going to find something, and because there's a million other, you know, drills around there, and you're going to get this kind of return. Then there's a guy doing a wildcat thing where you got a 1 in 10 chance of finding anything, but if you did, you're rich. And you know, I always found is that people find stuff, and it takes years and years for, like, maybe a road even, or certainly a pipeline or anything, to get close where they know. There was one guy, he ended up being one of our clients. They found a place that was the original Standard Oil found this thing in, I don't know, somewhere in Alaska in like 1957, and they knew there was oil there, but you know, finally the road got somewhere near there, and then somebody bought it, and the next guy bought it. They're like their fifth owner before they finally put a drill in the thing, and it had to be 20 years later. I mean, it's a fascinating industry.
Yeah, and it's you know, my background being a high yield bond manager initially, a lot of those companies were you know, tapping the bond market for money years ago, and so got an opportunity to meet them and really get to understand the industry. And it's you know, it's still there. You know, I think there's a lot of talk about climate change, but those companies that are already in place, especially on the gas side, for example, are the ones that are going to be in the best situation to reduce emissions and all that. So these gas companies that we've spoken about, Spire is one, Southwestern is another, and they have been very successful in getting the methane emissions down. That's part of their plan. So sometimes people just lump them all together and say this is, you know, that's part of that industry, with really not being able to differentiate between what they're doing and really, or even understand that they could be, you know, the best people to help the climate situation in the long run. These are the guys that know how to, you know, they've been in the business for a long time. I would trust them more than a new startup.
Well, Danny, I was reading something last night. I should have brought it up for you, but I think it was on CNBC, whatever it was later. And somebody was, you know, I've wondered if we have anybody with an ounce of brains, that is, we can't wait to get rid of every power plant, traditional power plant, and go to these electric cars. If somebody actually has a calculator and says, okay, if we ditch half the power plants and every car is going to be electric in 10 years, do we have any, are we going to have enough power for them? And it's,
yeah.
I mean, you know,
it's very true, yeah. And the cost, you know, yeah. Still the cost is still higher on the electric side.
Oh, yeah. Well, and this guy was saying that if you look at the amount of renewable energy type power, you know, power, wind, solar, all that kind of stuff, and whatever else you're going to do with it, There's no way the growth curve there is going to match what these guys think it's going to be in terms of how they want to, you know, shut down gasoline cars, shut down this, shut down diesel trucks. There's no way on earth that we're even close to matching their two ideas are going to match anytime soon.
Yeah, and the consumer, you know, you think about the person driving the car, it's not really that convenient if you drive an electric car and you get stuck. You know, where's the closest, you know, charging station and all that, and the inconvenience of the length of time it takes to charge. And I mean, there's a lot of other variables, and I don't think, you know, it's a one size fits all. I think this is a, you know, gradual transition, and you know, they're in it for the long run. So,
all right, Danny. So, allegedly, are you still here next week?
Yes, I'm coming. Yes,
we're making book on that. You know,
absolutely.
So, Southwest caused you to stop once. You're probably good with those guys. You might just have to drive.
I know. I mean, that may end up happening. Hopefully not. Hopefully not. But looking forward to being out there.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you. And both Ariel and Pearl said that they're going to come in with you here. We'll find some place to have breakfast or whatever, and or go to lunch. I don't know if any place is even open yet for breakfast. You'll be surprised. But what's not open here? You'll be stunned compared to Florida.
Yeah, we'll be.
Anyway, bud, we'll talk at you next week in person. That'd be fun.
Yep.
SP Futures up 6, NASDAQ Futures up 54. Be right back, Mr. John Flanagan.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you! Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 online on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello, everyone. Thanks, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tamales, Mr. Matt Weber on the board. S&P futures up 6.25, NASDAQ futures up 55, Dow futures up 6. Not much going on in individual stocks, especially in the Dow. American Express up 60 cents. We got a Merck up 230. It's a big move for Merck. I don't think they have their earnings yesterday. Maybe they did. Over in Europe, we've got, I should know that because I should have looked for earnings play, but I didn't. I looked over the other day. Anyway, DAX up 87.5%, FTSE up 32.5%, CAC around up 26.4%. Over in Asia, we got the Nikkei up 273.9. Now, these guys were very mixed yesterday, but now they're all up today. Shanghai up 28.8%, Hang Seng up 200.8%. So they're the Fed came in with the world's meagerest tapering, so the world is happy about that. Yesterday, Dow was up 104, S&P up 29, NASDAQ up 161. Bonds, 1.58, so unchanged there on a 10-year here. The Bund, minus 0.19, so they're actually going the other way. They're going lower. Japan, positive 0.08, so they're pretty much unchanged. Oil, up $1.40, that's 82.24. Brent up 159, 83.58. Natural gas up 5 cents, 5.71. RBOB up 4 cents, 2.38. Gold up $22 now to 17.85, but still, that's right where it was the other day. So it was down and now it's back up. Silver up 62 cents. Again, big moves within a range, 23.85. Copper up 5 cents, 4.37. And we've got the crypto down $1,400 to 61,576. Maddie, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
36 minutes past the hour. Good morning once again to everyone out there. Looks like earlier accidents on the Kennedy and the Dan Ryan have been cleared, so that's good news. Although the Kennedy appears to be a parking lot right now, approaching an hour from O'Hare into downtown as traffic is building heavily. No issues on the Edens. Traffic building steadily on the Eisenhower and Stevenson too, but no accidents to report. Same for the Tri-State to the south. That's got a lot of red, too. Dan Ryan, I-57, the Bishop Ford are looking good. We do have a crash on Lakeshore Drive, however. It's right at on the northbound side before 31st Street. It's blocking the right lane on the south side. Stop-and-go traffic on the northbound direction at near 31st Street on Lakeshore Drive. That's our slowest moving sort of expressway right now, if you call that an expressway. Off the expressways, up on the North Shore, US 41 at Park Avenue West, there is a crash. And then out in Wheaton, still working on that road construction that has Roosevelt Road closed between Route 59 and Neltner Boulevard. But everything else all quiet out there. Weather today, some sunshine, but cold temperatures, similar to what it's been all week. A high of just 47, which is about 8 degrees below normal. Right now it's clear and 37 degrees downtown. For our Phoenix listeners, sunny with a high of 89 today. Right now it's clear and 61. In sports, Bulls fell behind early, rallied back late, and tied it before falling in Philadelphia to the 76ers, 103-98. Blackhawks, it was the opposite. They had a 3-2 lead heading into the third period before giving up two third period goals to Carolina as they lost to the Hurricanes at home 4-3. NIU lost their shootout in college football to Kent State 52-47. Chief.
Here's a jab for you, Maddie. And if we have Jan with us. Jan, are you with us?
Yes. How
are you,
bud?
I'm doing good. Good morning to you, too. We have a question here for Mr. Weber, but feel free to opine in. Plus, I finally, here's a jab that when Maddie, John will be long gone. When Maddie retires, he can have this jab. He's on the Sabre Science and Baseball Committee. Sabermetric Science and Baseball Committee. This guy,
that
Eric,
sounds interesting.
Eric Van. Anyway.
I don't think that's a paying position, but.
Probably not.
Go ahead.
Who is the best player not in the Baseball Hall of Fame?
Pete Rose.
He's not counting him. I think he's figuring those guys are. But he doesn't understand why El Tiante is not in the Hall of Fame. I don't either. What is the story with him?
Who?
Louis Tiant.
Oh, Louis Tiant. I don't know. I'd have to go back and look at his stats. That was before my time, so I never got to see him play.
I think he lost a couple of games in the World Series late in his career against somebody like really good that was kind of held against him. But he claims that the two people that absolutely should be in by their stats, no matter how you slice it, and probably never get in, or the guy you always talk about, Kenny Lofton and Bobby Grich.
Interesting. So I talk about Kenny Lofton a lot because he's from Chicago and was a great basketball and baseball and football player, and actually played both baseball and basketball down at University of Arizona for Lou Dolson, and then had a great career in the major leagues playing for several teams, most notably the Cleveland Indians and the Atlanta Braves, but he also had a cup of coffee with the Cubs and was a big part of their 03 NLCS team. I never thought of him as a Hall of Famer, though. But now that we know what we know about stats, I mean, maybe he clearly was.
Well, that's the thing. I think people who go from team to team have a real problem.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're right. I think it was if he would have stayed in Cleveland his whole career and put up the numbers he did, maybe he'd be a lock for the Hall of Fame. But because he sort of bounced around the last 5 years of his career, it wasn't the case.
As that describes, for instance, Bobby Grich and Kenny Lofton, who have slam dunk on the field qualifications, according to this guy.
Kenny Lofton was one of the last great prototypical leadoff guys, because
we
just don't see that many of those anymore in baseball, for whatever reason. I mean, he was just a guy that you put at the top of the order. He would steal you 40 or 50 bases. He would get on base at a high clip, and he played center field and was great defensively, and he just wreaked havoc. And he was on a lot of winning teams because of that.
It's a little bit like what the Motion Picture Academy does every year, although you've got clear statistical data that you can use with the Hall of Fame. But there are some outcomes of, you know, choosing Hall of Famers that has always struck me as political or grudge-based or irrational or emotional. They have nothing to do with performance or statistical excellence. That's the only way you can explain the fact that some are not in, despite the record they had. So,
well, some guys that didn't like the reporters. Reporters weren't anxious to get them in.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt when you have writers who are, or you know, reporters or whomever that are literally putting these guys in via votes. If they don't like you, they're, all things being equal, they're going to leave you out, all things being equal. Now, if your stats are undeniable, that's different. I mean, a lot of people didn't like Mike Schmidt, but it was pretty undeniable that he was getting in.
Well, Carlton, too, they hated him.
Yeah, Carlton Fisk is another. There's definitely some unlikable guys. A lot of people hated Barry Bonds and couldn't wait, you know, love the fact that the steroid thing came out because they hated the guy because he was so hard to
cover.
Right.
Well, what do you suppose, what's going to be the end to all that? I mean, one of these guys was writing in last week, how the hell can you keep Pete Rose out when now you have people telling you to bet in the middle of the game?
Well, I agree. The thing with Pete Rose is, you know, he's betting on his own, he's betting on games that he's playing and managing. That's different than telling the fans to bet on a game. I think that Pete Rose should get in. I think that Shoeless Joe Jackson, 100 years later, should get in. I think that the steroid guys are a little bit different. To me, gambling is bad, especially if you're throwing games. I mean, that would be the worst, even though Pete Rose says he never bet against himself, which who knows if that's true or not. Shoeless Joe Jackson definitely did. At least that's the thought, which maybe that's different. The steroid guys, I mean, I don't know. I mean, Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds absolutely would have gotten in without the steroids. The steroids certainly made them superhuman and made them play forever at a high level, which is different. But would Sammy Sosa or Mark McGwire have been a Hall of Famer without the steroids? I mean, those guys were good ball players, no doubt, but all of a sudden they start hitting 60-plus home runs a season. I mean, they were never going to do that.
Well, the only thing about the steroids is, first of all, I could use some. there's no doubt that I could use the whole cocktail, but I don't see how it would help me hit the ball. Hit it far, yeah, and be in that kind of condition, yeah. And come
well,
back from
I mean,
injury
we've seen the difference. I mean, it allows you to stay healthier, and it allows you to hit the ball farther.
Yeah.
And so we saw guys in the 90s that had, you know, Luis Gonzalez is a perfect example, former Cub. He was a good ball player for the Cubs. Left fielder, Gonzo, but he was a doubles hitter.
He had warning track power.
Right, and he would maybe hit 18, 20 home runs, and all of a sudden he goes down to Arizona, allegedly juices up, and he's hitting 45, 50 home runs a season and becomes, you know, a legendary player for 5-6 years. I mean, that's a big difference, and you know, that's a problem.
Well, it depends kind of on the sort of on the person. I watched him a couple times when being a Cub fan at the time. Watched him in batting practice, and he had warning track power, and you know, and all of a sudden he's hitting the ball 30 feet further, and the difference in his 30 feet was between the warning track and the third row.
Right. Well, Mark Grace, if he would have done steroids and worried about his fitness more than worried about chasing tail down on Rush Street, God love him, he would have been a Hall of Famer. If I mean, he was such a good hitter and such a good defensive first baseman. If you could turn his 12 to 18 home runs a season into, you know, 28 to 38 home runs a season, he's a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Oh yeah.
And but he didn't do it, and that's what we're dealing with here. You know,
what I'm saying, Mark McGwire or like Dave Kingman. What did that guy need steroids for? Instead of going out of the park, he was going to hit the house across the street. I mean, there was no question.
Like Glenn Allen Hill did, who might have been on steroids.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, he was
a... But he was a big man, so he might not have been. I don't know.
You know, Glenn Allen Hill...
he hit that one on the roof, on the roof, which I've never seen before or since.
He must have had some wind, but still.
But still, he made, that was the longest home run I've ever seen at Wrigley. But was he on steroids? I mean, maybe.
Well, you know, he was... I remember the story. I don't know if it was one or none. Did he hit a home run his first time up in the Little League World Series? And he was intentionally walked every time at bat.
I don't know.
He was that good when he was 12, and he was.
And he was just a mediocre major leaguer.
Yeah,
I mean, he was not that, but he was a guy that if he ran into one, it was going to go a long way.
Yeah, he was a solid hitter. I mean,
he was okay. He was never an everyday player.
But he might have been if it was a DH.
Yeah, he could have been a DH in the American League for a couple years, but. Yeah, I mean, there was just some guys that if they got a hold of one, they could just hit it 500 feet, but they struck out a lot and couldn't really do anything else.
Well, and I'll go out on a limb and say it's kind of connected to what you and Lou were talking about earlier, because I think the Major League Baseball took a tremendous hit just in terms of its reputation because of the whole steroids episode. But you know, when you have fans that are deceived by what's going on, or it's a wink-wink kind of situation... nobody likes to be used. Nobody likes to be told, in effect, you know, we don't care what you think about it. We're lying to you here. That takes a huge chunk out of people's trust in so many ways. So, you know, the whole idea of whether, you know, Powell is lying or if he's just incompetent, it's worse if he's lying because we're being bamboozled. We're being told something that, you know, we have to assume would hurt us terribly if we knew exactly what was happening here. We've been targeted in some way, and you're just like Major League Baseball continued to accept people's, you know, hard-earned money for tickets and concessions and everything else, despite the fact that there was something fishy going on.
Well, yeah, I think the baseball absolutely was different. I'll bet Maddie could go back, not today, but maybe someday next week, maybe on Monday. I'll bet that year that Sosa and those guys had that home run derby.
98.
I'll bet you that
we've talked a lot about 1998 on the show today.
I will bet you that the money that people couldn't wait to go out and watch those guys play. I bet the Cubs gate, the other people's gates, and on the road.
There's a documentary about it, Chief.
Yeah.
They brought baseball back.
That's exactly right.
It was a strike year in 95, and the fans didn't come back. And then 98 was so exciting because of the home run race with Sosa and McGuire, it brought everyone back.
Yeah, well,
and then they had record attendance, like you're saying.
I knew you knew more about this than me.
That's exactly what happened, and they absolutely turned a blind eye to it on purpose because it was the first exciting thing to happen in baseball in so many years that, you know, they would have been stupid to shut it down.
I'll tell you what, Sammy Sosa's performance at the All-Star Game Home Run Derby, I'd watch that again tomorrow. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, the dude was, I mean, when he showed up the 1 year, John, and the guy from the equipment guy goes, "Hey, wait a minute! I gotta go up like two sizes in your shirt and pants."
Yeah,
McGuire.
Well,
they were
lying about it, right to their, you know, through their teeth about it, Tom. Too. I mean, nobody, I think, believed that they weren't using something, but the fact that you were supposed to believe their, you know, ridiculous denials. I think was offensive.
And he never, to the fans.
I mean, a lot of fans, you know, didn't care, and to this day don't care. And that's you know, that's to be understood, I guess. But for me, I mean, I thought, well, either you have rules, and you know, it's like, well, let's relax everything else too. If performance enhancing drugs are okay, and you can lie about it, and there's no consequences, what else are you lying about?
Well, we've got.
What else don't we have any evidence of that? Is not on the
America's episode. Favorite color man on TV now is A-Rod.
I mean, actually, everyone hates A-Rod on TV,
right.
but he, because he's so bad at it. But you're right; he did sort of revamp his image.
I saw the Mark McGuire just talk about the Cubs were playing. This is spring training back in the early '80s. Cubs are playing. They're both on the A's: Jose Canseco and Mark McGuire, right?
Yeah, and Tony La Russa was the manager.
Yeah, of course, he knew nothing about it, right? Now he's in the Hall of Fame.
Yes, he is.
But now, why that should be when his team was all juiced up?
Oh, he loved McGuire so much, he brought him to St. Louis with him.
Yeah, well, so these guys, they had to, in left field. They got this huge bus out there. One of the guys whacks one. It carries the bus. but then he was, McGuire was this big guy, but he was, you know, he wasn't heavy or anything like that. And all of a sudden, 5 years later, he's got this huge neck with a bunch of zits all over it. I'm going, that guy's roiding to beat the band. I mean, Dr. J knew all about roiding. He goes, God, that guy's on roids. You can tell by looking at him. I mean, it wasn't like people didn't want to, but, you know, it was interesting to watch. There's no doubt about that. I mean, but do people not want their football players juiced up? Did anybody care if the guys don't wear knee pads and they can run a little faster? It makes the game better, right? I mean, it's not like this is gladiator stuff, John. I mean,
but it's got consequences and injuries and seriousness of injuries too. So there's a price to all of this. And I guess when the fans kind of ratify what the owners and the players and their physicians have decided is going to be the new standard, you can't buck success if it sells tickets and nobody is particularly offended by it, such that they notice it in their income, then it's going to become the norm. But I just think it changed forever. For me, anyway, what professional sports was all about.
Well,
I do think
a laughing stock to me.
I do think baseball is different because I think people actually don't care if football or hockey or basketball players are on steroids or not. Because
they assume it seems mad,
almost to the point, where they
how could you deny it when you look at these people?
Right, and it doesn't necessarily make you better. But in baseball, it really, baseball is such a game where you compare eras, and it's such a big deal. And when all of a sudden mediocre guys are hitting 50 home runs a season, now no one hits 50 home runs. Now that they've gotten steroids out of the game, no one can even. I mean, there's only a handful of guys that can hit 40 home runs,
even though they swing for it on every single pitch.
Right. And now I think the pitching is tougher now because everyone's throwing 98 every single time.
But we don't worry about those guys on roids.
Well, that's true. But I mean, that's, you know, 98 was exciting and everyone was like, wow, this is crazy, and it brought fans back. But then by like 2001, everyone goes, wait a minute, this isn't what we want. We don't want guys hitting 60, 65, 70 home runs when, you know, historically hitting 50 home runs was a monster achievement. And
but you're right, they definitely had to do something after the strike.
Yep.
Because that had soured so many people. And it did make for exciting theater. But, you know, in retrospect, it was a flash in the pan, and it couldn't become the sort of thing that would be a success story season after season.
Exactly.
It was out of control.
John, you're just jealous you weren't Sammy Sosa's attorney. What was the statement? I've never broken the laws in the U.S., United States of America or the Dominican Republic, and I've never injected steroids into myself.
It sounds like Aaron Rodgers when he was asked in August, are you vaccinated? And he said, I'm immunized or whatever. And then everyone kind of was like, oh, okay.
It's like Bill Clinton.
Yeah, exactly. I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
I did not have sex with her. Oh, God.
Or how about Alderman Anthony Napolitano, who says he identifies as vaccinated?
Yeah, I would say that regarding the, I don't really want to limit here, but if you were in high school, let's say, and what happened to you happened to Bill Clinton, you would probably say you did not have sex.
I agree, 100%. There was very clear lines on what sex was.
Well, gentlemen never tell, you know?
Yeah. Well, that too.
That too.
Not that he was any gentleman.
No, Bill Clinton was a gentleman. I don't know about that necessarily. But, John, in regards to the Fed stuff yesterday, you know, it's making me grumpy, as Maddie probably knows. He has listened to me every day. But what I don't get are these people in these jobs are supposed to at least have some idea of the ramifications of what they're doing. And I still think that this, what they're playing with here is a total disaster for 80% of the population. You send everybody a $2,000 check and you raise the price of a used pickup truck by $5,000 and you think you did them a favor. I have, as you know, a lot of people that I are in the building and, you know, I cook here for people and I invite the guys that are the janitors in the place up to have breakfast and so forth. And all I hear about is, I can't believe how much the prices are going up and I haven't gotten a raise in 2 years. I mean, the amount of decimation you're going to do to 80 or 90% of the population that doesn't have the stock. But even then, even the 10% of the people who have all the stock, they're probably not going to get out the day before something happens and rates have to still flying up. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a net loss. It's not a net gain. I've seen it. I know it's not, especially if you're new in the market and you lose money, you can only deduct $3,000 a year from your other income. That if we collapse, I won't say when because I don't know, maybe we won't. If we collapse and these guys, let's just say, bleep this up and don't play it as finely as they seem to think that they're capable of, the ramifications are incredibly horrible, John, I think. I mean, I've seen it. So have you. I mean, and why are we taking this?
What's happening in Glasgow? You know, the whole climate so-called debate, which is really not a debate at all. It's just being ramrodded all over the world. That's an example too of a hastening of this disaster, because none of the solutions that I heard coming out of the thing will do anything other than just hasten what the Fed is doing here. It's going to tax people into submission. It's going to destroy their personal wealth. It's going to destroy their standard of living. It's going to destroy their grandchildren's standard of living. But that seems to be what we are buying into here, and that there's I don't hear any counter debate from anybody in the Fed. Occasionally one of the governors will be a little more, it sounded like it making a little more sense, but overall they're all singing the same tune. And look at Yellen. I mean, look at anybody else who's in a position to say, wait a minute, nobody is saying anything to stop it. So you got to believe it's been decided and it's going to happen, and whatever the consequences are, they know exactly who it's going to hurt too.
Well I honestly think, John, that you can change the weather and change the world toward the negative very easily, and I think a lot of countries are doing that. I don't think we are. I mean, we could be doing a little better, obviously, and over time we probably would. But I think that one of the young ladies who was here from on the Chinese agricultural group that was here for 2 weeks that we sort of housed, not housed, but they were using our office for lectures and so forth. And she told me there used to be like seven rivers going into Beijing, and they're like all dry except for one. I mean, they did the grazing so much in this one area that it's become desert. The desert is encroaching on Beijing by, you know, X number of miles per year or half a mile. I mean, I think the Chinese have screwed themselves up so bad that they have changed their climate. I mean, I really do. And a lot of it is, I mean, I think if you, You know, the Amazon keeps getting cut down a real. Once you cut it down, it's not coming back as a jungle. Climate makes its own climate, right?
Right, but you know, China and Russia, neither one were at this thing. So I mean, they're not contributing any of their data. They're not going to follow any recommendations. You can be sure. So you know, we got the rest of the world now deciding how China can be allowed to dig its way out of this mess, and everybody else is going to have to pay the tab for it. I mean, that's kind of the impression I get out of this whole discussion. It isn't about making it easier for people here to do anything. It's going to make us beholden to somebody halfway around the world who can pollute to their heart's content. I think the whole thing is a total misuse of our time and money, but again, it's what we're being sold, and you know, everybody, it seems, both sides of the aisle have signed on to it. And it's only the people who are seen as crazies who are digging in their heels about it.
And meanwhile,
I guess I'm one of those crazies. So,
well, let's put it this way, Jan: if you own Tesla and had it go up every single day because we're giving them money for carbon credits, you'd think it was the greatest thing on earth.
It is for them, sure.
I mean, you're just mad you don't own Tesla.
Yeah.
There you go. Well, who says he doesn't?
We're talking like Major League Baseball again.
Who says he doesn't? I could see you with 100,000 shares of Tesla, not telling anybody. Got it on the ground floor. SP Futures up 6, the SA Futures up 55. I think you should get an account here if you got that much in Tesla, for God's sake. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
What did we learn, Palmer?
I don't know, sir.
I don't know either. I guess we learned not to do it again.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to PTISecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at PTIProDirect.com. Nadex. Offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit Nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.